Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you are able to appreciate comedy and make the odd witticism and come across as a kind of, you know, as affable and open and, dare I say it, occasionally amusing, I think it definitely helps your ability as a leader to get people to commit to what you want them to do and to, if you like, whether leaders are also followers, and to kind of follow the vision and to do the best they can. So I think it's a pretty crucial quality for any leader.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are going to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a legendary lifer in the delightful charity Comic Relief, where he served as chief executive for 19 years. He is the creative mind behind the iconic Sports Relief and Make Poverty History, in addition to organising almost two decades worth of the internationally celebrated Red Nose Day. He was appointed Commander of the Order of the British Empire in 2016 and was named as Honorary Lifetime President by Comic Relief for the career he built combining comedy and caring. More importantly, his work has inspired hours and hours of laughter and saved many lives by motivating masses of people to be funny for money. Kevin Cahill, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Thank you for that, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to see you again. It's been a while since I've seen you, and I know that you've done so much astounding work. Your extraordinary career centred around tapping the power of comedy to change lives. Now, the Jesuits say, give me a child of seven and I will give you the man. Was the young Kevin Cahill aware that comedy was a potentially powerful tool?
It depends how young you're going when you say it was the young. I certainly wasn't at birth, and I've probably been someone who has enjoyed comedy, has come across it, but it was certainly just haphazard and a stroke of luck that I ended up at an organisation called Comic Relief, and the power of comedy to change lives and to make extraordinary things happen only really resonated with me properly once I stepped through the portals of that organisation and began, if you like, living it on a day-to-day basis, really, yeah.
Come back to Comic Relief because it's such a hugely important part of your life. But was humour valued in your family when you were growing up?
I had a, you know, pretty traditional working class background, Irish father who married and kind of met a young English woman during the war when the Irish came to the UK to run the factories while the British men went to war. And so as such, it was, I'd say we managed to have a laugh, but it wasn't particularly celebrated. And I guess the only manifestation of it would be probably the time we spent together watching television, where Morecambe and Wise were on television, you know, Des O'Connor, Dave Allen. So we consumed that together as a small family. But really, life was about generally getting by and surviving in a tough world as well. So I would say that I don't think either of my parents were particularly funny. They didn't tell jokes, but we did manage to have a laugh at times by, you know, just as most ordinary families would. Yeah.
That's really interesting, because you talk about, you know, a reasonably tough upbringing and most of the time spent concentrating on surviving. You've helped disadvantaged people in both the UK and some of the poorest communities around the world. Do you think that humour is more abundant in those poorer communities as a necessity?
Well, I tell you, I wouldn't claim to, if you like, be an expert on how necessary it is. And I think all communities have their ability to laugh and the things that make them laugh. But I'll tell you what's interesting, that just I do think certain types of humour, if you take slapstick, or generally work in most cultural contexts and for most communities and most people. There's a difference, I think, between wordplay and witticism and ironic observation and slapstick. And so humour, I'm sure plenty of your guests on this podcast would have talked about these type of things. But I think I think every community has ways of laughing, and that situations that crop up and occur that are funny. I mean, I was just thinking that when Richard Curtis, who got me to go to Comic Relief, he tells this story, which is probably relevant to this little strand of the conversation, about when he'd had the idea after Live Aid that the comedians might be able to do something similar to the musicians and the musical community and make a difference. So he went on a fact-finding trip to Ethiopia, because it was post the 1984 famine, and he'd ended up in a refugee camp in the Sudan, just across the Ethiopian border. And what was happening there was there were three tents where sick children were being triaged. So there was one tent where the kids who had little chance of getting through it were being looked after, a middle tent where they had kind of reasonable chance, and then the third tent where there was the best chance. And he recalls being in that medium tent, and there was this thing that Lenny Henry used to call the flying pants. It was a way of weighing a small child by putting them in these pants that were on a kind of scale, and you could get their body weight. And this particularly emaciated young boy was put in there, and he was so tiny that he fell through and landed on the floor and started crying. And Richard was then kind of, with his Western kind of sensibilities, thinking, God, what a terrible thing. And all the women in the tent burst out laughing. So it was an immensely tragic situation where a moment of slapstick brought out the humour and made everyone laugh. And I tell that story because Richard says that's the moment he realised this thing called comic relief could exist, because actually it was comedy in the face of terrible tragedy. And the two are able to sit, if you like, side by side. So I suppose the point I'm making is that slapstick can be funny for all kinds of people, and it can occur in any situation and break the mood and the tension, or make kind of tragic things happier, just even if it's for a fleeting moment. So I've never forgotten that story.
No, and it's such a powerful story, isn't it? And when you see the kind of suffering that you and Richard Curtis and all the Comic Relief people have seen that suffering close up, do you think that humour actually aids resilience for those people? That laughing at the situation, which you can't do anything, is part of aiding that resilience?
I'm sure laughter could always aid resilience. I mean, I wouldn't be, if you like, so presumptuous to speak on people's behalf with that. But certainly everywhere I've travelled, the people I've seen, the places I've been, Laughter is a great way of humanizing, bringing people together, and creating a sense of comradeship and empathy and solidarity. So I think it's one of the most powerful emotions in a way that can cut through anything and can also connect you with people who you wouldn't necessarily ostensibly on the surface of things feel an immediate connectivity with because of the difference in your cultural, economic and, you know, situations. But actually humor can cut through and make things work.
So you're talking about it, if I'm correct, and thinking in a bonding way, that it's an automatic bonding tool.
Yeah. I remember, again, a similar thing, being in Ghana. We'd taken a football team to play, and so the sport and the football were bringing communities together. And Frank Skinner and David Baddiel were going to meet this community and to do some filming. And as Frank walked into the hut we were going to film in, he bashed his head, and it was another piece of slapstick. And then all the women in the room, because it was a woman's project we were visiting, again burst out laughing, and that broke the ice immediately, because there was a kind of tension pre-recording. So, well, how's it going to go? Is it going to develop its own momentum? Will it work for everybody involved? And that just kind of you know, Frank reacting to banging his head meant that people went, oh, well, these guys are okay, because, you know, they bang their heads like us, and so it's funny. Yeah.
Well, that's it. It's one of the few things in the world that everybody can relate to, isn't it? It's a simple sort of hands across the ocean, if you like, of a thing we understand. You know, somebody falls over, somebody bangs their head. It's funny, as long as the person takes it well. Of course, if the person takes it well, which I know Frank would have done, it takes it well and laughs at himself, that also eases the tension, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I on a similar note, I'm going to put my glasses on here. We were with a group and introducing ourselves in the middle of the north of Kenya with a community. And it came round to Steve Coogan. They said, well, and he went, my name's Steve Coogan, I'm a comedian. For those people listening to this on audio, he just adjusted the alignment of his glasses so they fitted askew across his face. And a simpler gesture as that, as I've just done by adjusting my glasses, actually had everybody laughing. So some people are blessed with comedic instincts and creativity and can just do a little thing like that which provokes humor, and then the humor brings people together. So I think it's a fantastic tool for doing that.
Would you must intrinsically understand this, because you have been around comedians and funny people, but having to lead from the front, I mean, you led Comic Relief, if I'm right, from a 20-person startup to 300 staff and 100 million a year income. So is leadership enhanced by the ability to laugh, the ability to allow humour to actually evolve in the business situation?
Well, it's interesting asking questions about leadership. I mean, I think that I've got my own views on it, and I think a leader needs all kinds of things, like a kind of a vision, integrity and openness with people, the ability to own up to things that don't work well so that you can get things back on track. But I think also when people look at you as a person, your personality, and the kind of man or woman you are, then if you are able to appreciate comedy and make the odd witticism and come across as a kind of, you know, as affable and open and, dare I say it, occasionally amusing, I think it definitely helps your ability as a leader to get people to commit to what you want them to do, and to, if you like, whether are leaders or also followers, and to kind of follow the vision and to do the best they can. So I think it's a pretty crucial quality for any leader to be able to, I suppose, appreciate comedy, and as far as their abilities allow.
So in essence, do you think that the humour humanises people, and leaders need to an extent be humanised in order to connect, and without followers, the leader's just a bloke on his own?
Yeah, a bloke or a woman on their own. But I think that
that's true.
I think essentially it kind of it adds warmth and texture to relationships, and it helps people therefore feel comfortable in your company, and also to kind of believe in you more, and therefore can develop a kind of loyalty and a level of support that you wouldn't get without it.
Yeah, so I think we're talking about whether that leader is male or female, a rapport that it helps to oil the wheels of business, as it were. And if you haven't got rapport with people, I think it is harder as psychologists to get people to follow you and follow where your vision.
It is. And of course, you mentioned the time I spent, which was a great time running Comic Relief. But of course, if your company's name is Comic Relief, then it stands to reason that comedy or comic bit of it is going to be important, isn't it? Because actually comedy was our operating sphere. It was the thing that made us stand out. So Comic Relief sums it all up. And we were lucky. Personally, I was lucky because I'm not particularly comedic myself, but I had the pleasure and the privilege of working with people for whom comedy was their kind of professional métier, and who relied on it for their career and their support, and the millions of people who laughed at their jokes or the work that they did. So it was, in that respect, it was fantastic.
Well, I'm interested because you said that I'm not particularly comedic myself, but the whole humorology project is not just about making jokes and doing gags. It is about having the humility. It's about having the ability to humanize people, to let humor flow. And sometimes the most important person is somebody who allows humor to happen, who leads from the top, who lets it happen, isn't it? Can you talk a little bit about that thing of allowing it rather than I don't think you have to be. I think one of the things you can do to really aid humor is to be a good audience.
Basically, people spend a lot of time at work, and depending on what their job is, it could be 8 hours a day, it could be up to 12 hours a day or whatever. And I certainly used to say to the new beginners of Comic Relief that in a sense, because they're spending such a huge amount of their life then in the office, I mean, now it's a bit different because people are working from home, and that in a sense, it was their responsibility as well to enjoy being there, to have fun. I mean, having fun at work was as important in some ways as the crucial nature of the work, because if you're in a workplace where you're bonding with people, you're having a laugh and you're kind of enjoying what you're doing, then as far as the company or organization's concerned, they're going to benefit from that kind of vibe and that atmosphere. And so I was always, if you like, determined to let people laugh, have fun, enjoy the fact that they were working in a community where that was allowed and they could actually relax and chill and enjoy downtime as well as the critical work that they're engaged to do. But you mentioned that there was a point at which the organisation was raising £100 million a year. That's not an easy thing to do. It's a very pressurised environment. And rising to the challenge of it can be quite demanding and ask a lot of people. Therefore, you need that ability to kind of debunk it a bit and to enjoy it and to tell jokes, have fun with your colleagues in order for the community of it to work in the most efficient and productive way to deliver the best results. So I'd say that comedy or humour and humorology, as you call it, is critical in that sphere.
I think you're 100% right. And it's lovely to hear somebody who has led such a big operation talk in those terms, because a lot of our listeners will be not comedians in business, in areas. And actually, I think everybody needs to know that it adds to the bottom line. That, I mean, if people have a real purpose, if they're happy at their work, if they feel that they can have a laugh with people, they are going to be ultimately happier and more productive.
Yeah, and I think that I was thinking as we came into this of moments. I used to work at the National Theatre before I went to Comic Relief, and I used to produce small-scale tours, and we were going around the country and having to just get the packaging and the equipment right to take some actors overseas. And we'd bought these massive bags to see if we could get all the equipment and the costumes and stuff in them. And I remember that one of my friends from then who was working with me, basically we were trying to test out the load-bearing capacity of this bag. So I persuaded her to get in it, and she climbed into this bag. It was a soft bag, not a suitcase, and it had a zip, and so I zipped it up. So her head and neck were sticking out of the top, and as chance would have it, it was the first week that Richard Eyre had taken on the job of being the director. I'd taken over from Peter Hall as the director of the National Theatre, and he happened to be doing a walk around saying hello to people at the moment when I was carrying this bag around the office with one of the team in the bag with her head, if you like, sticking out. And we just had to tough it out, you know, to pretend it was like an everyday occurrence and activity. And it was quite proper, really, that we were load testing this luggage. And to give Richard his due, he went along with it. But he could have left that room thinking, what a bunch of idiots, you know, this is what I've walked into with kind of people like that working for me. But it broke the ice. It made him kind of understand that there were, people who had a sense of humour in his team. And we went from strength to strength and all got on with him. And, you know, the rest is history. So that was just a moment when humour broke the spell. But it was a kind of like just something I remember fondly, actually. Yeah.
Well, isn't that because, you know, there's a saying that you never get a second chance to make a first impression.
Yes.
And actually, that first impression still sticks with you with Richard Eyre from those days at the National Theatre. And it could have gone completely the other way if Richard Eyre had suddenly gone, well, what the hell do you think you're doing? I pay you to do this. But I actually think that's incredibly wise to actually go to those places and go, it's a bit of fun. This should be encouraged. I think that any business can get better if they do have that lightness in there, because I don't think it detracts from the seriousness. You, I think, have proved, and one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you, is that you can take the most serious things in the world, which are, you know, are poverty, and, you know, with through making poverty history and sports, and add a lightness of touch, and they sit comfortably together because it's for a good reason.
Yes, and we used to say and make the claim a bit that Comic Relief helped put the fun into fundraising. If you look at fundraising in the period, if you like, before it existed, I think there was a greater kind of seriousness about it. It was perhaps about guilt trips and feeling guilty about doing things or doing things for, you know, for quite kind of serious reasons. And then when you suddenly have things where people are kind of shaving their beards off for Comic Relief or sitting in the bath of baked beans, or which is kind of slightly ridiculous, all of it. But we basically said to the British people, think of the, you know, most eccentric and amusing and wacky things that you, although I hate the word wacky, but wacky things that you can. And you know, put them on display and ask your mates and family to kind of, as in return for you making a fool of yourself, to give you some money, and that money then will be used for a serious purpose. So I think that notion that fundraising can be fun was in some ways born with the very early comic relief, because prior to that, it hadn't really been a feature of the fundraising landscape. And if you look at the fundraising landscape now, it's happening everywhere and with all different kinds of people and communities. And so, but certainly the fun element of it encouraged the giving and the charitable aspect. And so they went hand in hand. And as a result, it's been an enormous success story.
But I actually think that you also did business a huge favor, because you allowed, maybe it's just that one day a year when, you know, because suddenly you saw businesses, you know, having, you can come dressed as anything you want in the business. It created a lightness in the workplace as well. And you allowed that to happen. And so I think you probably changed the course of business as well, doing it.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, there is certainly the Lord of Misrule takes over on that day. I mean, it did. It was obviously, as we just said, it was relatively innovative and new. But when you hear stories of, you know, chief executives taking the tea trolley around the offices and, you know, job swapping and role swapping, and teachers in schools becoming the pupils and the pupils becoming the teachers, and all of those things. It's just a kind of moment where we say, well, normal rules are suspended and let's see a different side of each other. And it can humanize the managers and the bosses, who can show that they've got a sense of humor and that they're prepared to fall in with a joke. And it can, you know, make the teams feel motivated and kind of warmer towards the company because of those things that have happened. I remember Justin King, who was the chief executive of Sainsbury's, who we did a big multi-year deal with to be the purveyors of the Red Nose and to help us promote Red Nose Day. And boy, did they do a brilliant job. But in talking to Justin about the rationale and the reasons why they made the choice to strike up the partnership in the way that they did, the first reason they often quote, or he quoted, was more to do with his team, where they're called colleagues at Sainsbury's, but the impact it had on the staff team and the staff team's sense of the company and their kind of, you know, feeling proud and passionate about the good work that was being done with the money that they'd helped to raise over the tills and through their own fundraising activities. And so that bringing of the sense of fun into a serious world of work for a limited period, you can't do it 365 days a year, but on the days when it happens, it certainly, I think, brings senior management and teams together in a joint sense of purpose. But the thing that held it together was a sense of comedy or fun or humour, because it was all built around humour. So I think you're right in that.
Absolutely. I've just realised that maybe unconsciously I've nicked your idea, because you said that Comic Relief put the fun into fundraising. And I said in my introduction that humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to thank you for unconsciously for giving me that line.
You'll be hearing from my solicitors later.
It's a fair cop. Society's to blame. What makes you laugh, Kevin?
If you'd asked me that 2 months ago, I'd give you a different answer to today. But we have recently acquired a puppy called Veronica Merrylegs Bucket Barker, or Runny Barker for short. Oh. And she's a little kind of Jack Russell cross. And I have to tell you, this dog has like had us hooting with laughter in this household just because of the behaviour of a puppy running around you when you go out and come back, and they go, oh, they're back. Oh, yeah, where have you been? I've just been waiting for you. Like, just be welcoming you at the door, stealing shoes and hiding them. You can't find things that were there, you know, half an hour ago, and you're rushing to go out. So currently in my life, this little thing, which is just kind of 5 months old, is making us laugh our socks off. Actually, she's taking our socks off and hiding them. So that's the thing that's making me laugh most at the moment, just the joy of a little kind of creature coming into the household. And then obviously other things, a great sitcom. I mean, Richard used to say that there are two great sitcoms every decade, but certainly I was working in Sweden when Fawlty Towers came out, so I missed the initial broadcast of it. And then when I did see it, there were moments where I had to switch the television off because I thought I was going to have a heart attack laughing so much. So great sitcoms, great stand-up. I mean, Victoria Wood, as a stand-up, you just couldn't beat. And so, you know, you can find humour and laughter everywhere, but currently it's a five-month-old puppy called Veronica Merrylegs Bucket Bark.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tell me a true funny story about something that's happened to you.
Okay, here we go. I was on a couple of days break in Stockholm. I'd gone, you know, for a long weekend or something. I was in a museum there. But still, as this is the modern way, working as I went on my mobile, and then a message came in about something I've been working on for a good few months, which was actually to do with Clarence House and who were then the young princes. I mean, they were probably in their early 20s. And I've been trying to get them to do something for Sport Relief. We were very, very close to it. So the thing came in that said, unfortunately, this is one of my staff team. Unfortunately, having considered it fully, I've had this email that says, we're sorry on this occasion. We're not going to be able to get involved. Yeah, and I was always a very determined person when I was trying to get people to do things, usually for nothing. And so I pinged off a reply and said, excuse the French, fucking typical, you know, all mouth and no trousers. What are we going to do now? You know, and it was a fairly robust thing to my assistant. But I'd done that terrible thing of pressing copy everybody. And so the message had gone to the team at Clarence House. And the moment it had gone, I'm just going, oh, my God, what? Like, this is it. It's just ruined my career. There goes my CBE. Luckily, I got it later. But my knighthood. And so you just left there standing in this kind of quiet place thinking, what can I do? Because in those days, there was a thing where, if you remember, where you could try and recall an email. I don't think it ever worked.
No, I don't think
you can do it now. And so like an hour later, I thought I better. So I sent a thing to Clarence House saying, look, I'm really sorry. It's just that I was so frustrated. Just kind of my frustration got the better of me, and I pinged this reply up. I'm sure you've seen it and read it, and all I can do is apologise. And And luckily for them, they came back, and this will play to your themes here. And they said, we've been pissing ourselves laughing for the last hour in the office because we realised what a tragic mistake it was, and we wondered how you were going to deal with it. So don't worry.
That's so lovely that there is a denouement in the story, which was actually that it's a good thing. But also there's something from a psychological perspective, owning up and just putting your hand up and going.
Well, I couldn't see any other way out of it. Just saying, I better take it on the chin and take it before he confessed it too long, because it was certainly a classic mistake.
So you've worked with all these extraordinary comedians from all over the world over the years. Is everyone potentially funny, or is it a gift given to the few?
Well, I think it depends on the gradation of it. That I think to be supremely funny and have the ability to make millions of people laugh is a gift that is restricted to the few, because it's a definite skill. There's different bits of people's brains that are properly developed in a way that lend themselves to that. And even within that, people are funny in different ways. So I don't think everybody is funny, but I think there is humour in situations that everybody finds themselves in. And sometimes they only feel funny in retrospect, you know. It's whether how I'm a person who doesn't deal very well with practical jokes. I remembered a couple of situations where friends putting kind of fart powder in a curry that I was eating once. Tragically, it didn't sink into the curry. So it was like sitting on the table. They distracted. And I'm looking at this little yellow stuff and thinking, what the hell? Everyone at the table is pissing themselves laughing because the joke was going to be on me. And so I didn't find it funny. I didn't find it funny at all. But as I tell you this little story now, it's hilarious because, you know, on reflection, it was funny. I remember going for like a skinny dip years ago with my partner, Becky, and the family took our clothes off in the car and drove away. And we were left on this lakeside in the south of France, stark bollock naked, you know, and I have to say I didn't find that funny. But actually, again, as I recount the story to you, it's something I've remembered in my life, because to then it was totally hilarious. And he comes up every now and then, family events where I remember the time when we... So actually, I think there's humour in situations, even though everybody isn't naturally funny. I think the very funny are gifted. I think they get to places that us mere human beings can't get to in their scripting and performance and stuff. But I think it is a gift to be genuinely funny.
So do you think it's essentially a superpower at that point whereby the neural pathways are so quick that they can do it? Because, you know, we both know a lot of comedians, and there's something, I always liken it to a really good sports person, or, you know, like a footballer who when they describe, they have lots of time when the ball comes to them. It's like it's in slow motion for them. And I always think that comedians, the really good ones, it is kind of like time slows down and they see loads of different routes that would be and see the funny bit.
And look, anyone who was lucky enough to see Robin Williams, when I saw him in the West End, and he did this thing, it's probably a shtick that he does all the time. So even though it's felt kind of random and improvised, but he came back after the final encore once the house lights came on and just did this thing where said, someone give me a word, and someone in the audience suggested a word or a thought or a phrase, and he just basically went off on one and he riffed on, and in that 30 minutes extracurricular performance at the end of the show, you could see he had the most amazing imagination and fluency, and was an extraordinary human being. And so I think it is for people like that, It is a superpower. It's just something that marks them out from them. And thank goodness for it, because actually we get the pleasure from seeing them perform and do that, you know.
Yeah, but just so our listeners aren't completely put off, you know, that this is just a gift from God and everything. As from a psychological perspective, I believe that people can get better at this stuff. Yeah. You know, there are ways on doing it. Having been surrounded by comedians, do you think you maybe consciously or unconsciously got better at spotting where the funny is?
Well, I'd like to think so, but it's not necessarily made me any funnier. But I guess the areas where I can manage it a bit are around awful puns or witticisms or incongruities. And so it's that, or if you like, observations of funny things that have happened. So that's the only area in which I would give myself credit. Or walking into glass doors and bashing my nose on the door, not having seen that there was a glass door there in the first place. I mean, I've been good at that over the years, and not nearly knocking myself out, but I wouldn't claim any kind of conscious involvement in that. It was just a terrible piece of slapstick.
What would the world be like without humour, Kevin?
In terms of your own well-being and sense of self, if you can laugh out loud and enjoy things, that the endorphins it kind of releases and things like that. I think, first of all, make you feel better about yourself. If you have a good laugh with somebody, and that's what everyone loves to do with their friends or their family, it's the most amazing just feeling. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that just this ability to connect people and to humanize us. And because we've talked quite a bit about slapstick and things that have worked on that level, but it brings people together. So I think, I know someone's saying that money makes the world go around. It was in Cabaret, wasn't it? But I'd say for me, I'd replace money with laughter and humour that makes the world go around. I think it's a more powerful engine.
I think that is such a wonderful point, is like that laughter does make the world go round, because you can have all the money in the world, but you may not have the laughs. I think it's about connection, because there was a very interesting study in America where they thought that they'd found the healthiest place in America because they lived 17 years longer than anywhere else. And they thought they probably didn't smoke, didn't drink, and ate healthy. When they got there, they all drank, smoked, and ate fatty foods. But what they had was a sense of community.
Yeah.
A sense of togetherness, a sense of laughing together and bonding together. And actually, that was what they discovered, the social scientists discovered, actually brought longevity on. And like you said, the endorphins, the serotonin, the dopamine, the oxytocin that's produced, that is life enhancing. And laughter is life enhancing.
Yeah, and there's that, is it the book called The Spirit Level? You might have come across it, but it argues that the richest communities in the world are often the most unhappy, because actually it's it's the age-old cliche that money can't buy you happiness. But because if people who gather together in those communities then feel they need a different level of security and protection, they can't just walk out onto the street and they have to be driven everywhere. So I think there is a lot of sense in that, really. The countries where the gap between the richest and the poorest is the narrowest, and they often point to countries like Norway, where people are happier, because that sense of inequality isn't as pronounced as in other places.
Yeah, I agree. I work in Norway a lot, and I agree that there's something about that equality of life where everybody, it does lift everybody up, because that nobody feels downtrodden, perhaps, and they do laugh easily, the Norwegians. If I asked you to write a business case for humour, what would you put in it, Kevin?
Well, again, based on my own experience of running a large organisation, I think that because, as we were just saying, if humour can drive a sense of well-being, a sense of kind of happiness, so it can connect people. And I think if the more humour and connectivity there is in the workplace as a result of it, the harder people are likely to work, the more productive they're likely to be, and the better benefits it's going to bring to the business as a whole. So I would argue that a happier, well-motivated, fun-loving community is going to be, you know, better set against the bottom line as one where people are a bit downtrodden, a bit unhappy, don't feel motivated, and don't have that same sense of well-being that's brought about by humour. So that's what I'd say. That's how I begin to make the business case.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a huge return on investment, isn't it, really, for people if they're thinking about why should they do it? Well, people are motivated, less sick days, less, you know, issues with mental health. I think businesses don't think enough about the human level, that you're dealing with lots of individuals who have needs. And one of the first things is a need to belong.
Yeah. And so if you're running that company or near part of the senior management team, I think it's incumbent on you to try and create the culture and atmosphere where people can feel they belong, where their achievements get celebrated and mentioned and talked about. But at the same time, if people underperform in any way, so you have techniques and mechanisms to deal with that underperformance, because people need to know what their job is, what the brief is, and what's expected of them. So I think clarity of communication and setting of realistic targets, which then can be celebrated when they're achieved and make people feel better, is critical, really.
I couldn't agree more. You've spent years persuading celebrities to undertake grueling physical challenges.
Yeah.
How important is humour in the art of persuasion, do you think?
What I'd say is, a lot depends on who you're talking to and what they're, how up for things they are, you know? So it was interesting when David Walliams swam the channel for comic relief, sport relief. And it was the first, really, of these mega challenges. So actually, I think I'd argue that it established a new genre that's been copied ever since by sort of flattery being, you know, the sincerest form of, imitation being the sincerest form of flattery. But I'd gone to Ethiopia with David and Matt Lucas, who then, you know, Little Britain was at its height, actually. And on the way back on the airplane, I'd said to David, "Do you like sport?" And he said, "Well, I hate sport. I was terrible at it at school and just didn't like it at all. But the one thing I did like was swimming." And actually, weirdly, the thought has occurred to me occasionally that I might try and swim the English Channel, at which point I said to him, "You've just told the wrong person." So if you're thinking about humour, I said, because actually in 3 months' time, you're going to get a phone call from me, and I'm going to say, "Remember you mentioned this kind of foolish idea that you might swim the Channel? Well, if you're serious about it, we can put the underpinning of it together, the logistics and the support mechanism, and we could try and get you across the channel." And he was, they were touring Little Britain live. So, and he said, "Yeah, let's try it then." And so what we started doing is wherever he was in the country, Bolton, Huddersfield, Sunderland, we would book a lane in the local swimming baths at kind of 8 o'clock the next morning after a show. And he would diligently head down there and swim, and swam for an hour, swam for 2 hours, swam for three, and built up the endurance. We had a great guy called Greg White, who was a kind of ex-Olympian, who became a kind of mentor and consultant, because he swam in the pentathlon in the Olympics of Barcelona, therefore was a great swimmer in his own right. And And the, as they say, the rest is history. He was the first cross-dressing comedian to swim the Channel in under 10 hours. It put him in the top 50 of all time of having done it. And David will tell you now he's more famous for that than for anything else. And every time if he gets in the London taxi, they kind of go, oh, Dave, you've been swimming lately. So that everyone loves and celebrates the fact that he did that. And then subsequently, of course, he swam the River Thames from Letchley down to Westminster. But I mean, I'm surmising in retrospect, but I guess the ability to turn that kind of innocuous conversation into a kind of little humorous exchange might have played a role in his doing that. And he raised over £1 million. And then when he swam the Thames, I think it was £3 million. And that money went on to do extraordinarily positive things in the lives of disadvantaged and vulnerable individuals and communities. So, yeah.
Just from those little acorns of a little bit of humour and persuasion, that massive influence, not just on one person to swim, but on that influence that pervades your whole career, whereby all these people were affected by that. So just that alone is a reason to improve. I always think of it as good humour, be humorous rather than, and humourful and get that into your life, because then you can persuade and you can influence and do great things for the world. We've reached a part of our show, Kevin, that we like to call Quick Fire Questions.
Quick Fire Questions!
Who's the funniest business person you've met?
This is an interesting question about funny business people, because I've been lucky enough to visit hundreds of projects, if you like, in the UK and the developing world. And I've got a strong memory of... I went to the Kibera slum in Nairobi, which was a million people, a slum the same size as Bristol. But within it is this incredibly vibrant internal community, because people need to get their hair cut, they need to buy clothes and sell clothes, get things cleaned, get food. And so one of the things that you learn early on when you make these visits is that is just how kind of alive and vibrant these informal settlements and poor communities are. But within that, there was a woman called Sister Anne, who I'm referring to her as a businesswoman because she ran this charity, but it was the business of the charity. She had to bring in the resources and the money to help keep that community ticking over and to put food onto the plate and get medical attention for kids who needed it, or schools and lessons prepared and so on and so forth. And she, the reason she was funny is she just had the ability to kind of get things out of people. I remember being there and visiting her project with Russell Brand, who had a gorgeous kind of pair of probably brand new Timberland boots that he probably bought for the trip because he knew that he'd be doing some walking. And on the last day we were there, the boots were got mud all over them because we'd been walking, it had been raining, and her saying to him, look, his feet looked the same size as her son's, and weren't they gorgeous boots? And 5 minutes later, she had the boots off him, and they were being kind of stashed away to hand over to his son. Another friend of mine went to see her, and by the end of the visit, she committed to buying a new cooker and a fridge for the central community centre. So she was funny, not in the sense she was able to tell hilarious stories, but she was funny just because of the determination and the persuasive power she had to unlock things from people who were visiting, obviously from funders like Comic Relief, but of course all the things that went back into that community helped deliver a more sustainable lifestyle. And there was even one street there, which this is the canny individual she was, where through a micro credit program, people have been able to borrow money to buy initial stock of vegetables for a vegetable store, or buy the equipment to do fruit pressing so they could sell fruit juice, or the scissors and dryers for a hair salon. And so there was a street where a lot of the money that had come from the British public had helped establish small businesses, you know. And she, of course, named the street Red Nose Street. So whenever we went to visit, we were taken up Red Nose Street, made to feel, well, that's great that, you know, there's a whole place here that we've been able to help facilitate through the imagination of this one woman, Sister Anne. And so I'd say, so she was the funniest business leader I've met, but for not perhaps for the reason one might normally have thought about it.
That's wonderful. It just makes me want to meet Sister Anne, really. And I know I'd turn my pockets inside out as soon, just because she sounds the most wonderfully amusing and persuasive person. Wonderful story. What book makes you laugh, Kevin?
Well, I've chosen, there's a book, the Irish writer called Flann O'Brien, who was a columnist for the Irish Times, who wrote this book. It was a short stories, really, or pieces, called Miles and Agopaline. And I would recommend it to anybody. I mean, basically, it's just these kind of flights of fantasy around, you know, moments. There's a story called A Horde of Unemployed Ventriloquists, and basically it describes going to the theatre, the Abbey Theatre, and the people... because there were lots of social climbers in the audience, they wanted to appear witty and urbane and, you know, be the kind of, I suppose, the pinnacle of Dublin society. And so they would take a ventriloquist with them to the theatre, who would then be able to throw insults around the auditorium to other people in the theatre. But then those people had ventriloquists as well, who would then throw a return insult back. And it's just the most kind of extraordinary picture of this like 1,000 people in a theatre.
What film makes you laugh?
Well, I'm going to have to say here, a film by one of my mentor and great colleagues and friends, Richard Curtis. So it was before Weddings and a Funeral. I mean, it was one of Richard's early ones. But I think he was at an age where he was being invited to weddings most weeks. You know, you get to a certain age where all your mates and your network are getting married. And he tells the story that going to those weddings inspired him to write that book. And then, of course, threw in the funeral as a little additional kind of frisson. And then he also tells amusing stories about how he had to fight to get the title past the kind of the backers and the producers, because the title of a movie with the word funeral in it wasn't necessarily, and it was a romantic comedy, going to be the kind of most winning title. But he stuck to his guns, and actually it's a play of words now that gets used in a lot of situations, isn't it? But so, yeah. For Weddings and a Funeral would be my choice, out of both the fact that it made me laugh out loud, but also loyalty and solidarity with an old friend.
Well, it is genius. It really is. Taking a shift to the other side, Kevin, what is not funny?
Well, I think I'd say jokes that are at someone else's expense, which actually can be quite painful and difficult. But they might be done in all seriousness, not to hurt somebody. But I think humour has that ability to wound and to upset as well. And then, of course, without getting, you know, we're allowed to get a bit political on this, but I think lack of integrity, broken promises, I think I would observe in the age we're living in that someone like Jacob Rees-Mogg, I mean, I'm personalising this now, but when seeing him in his privileged position in the House of Commons as a leader of the House, trying to duck out of responsibility and shift the blame or not step up to the plate when it's expected that that's what courage and bravery should make you do, I think that's not funny. I think also our prime minister's attempts to be funny are often just not funny enough. The way he ruffles his hair to give that kind of impression of a slightly tousled, witty, you know, man full of classical illusions. But I think most of the illusions would go over most people's heads. I mean, they certainly go over mine, a lot of them. And so I think, you know, kind of false promises, a kind of lack of moral fibre and a lack of integrity around things that you should be doing because of the position you've been elected to in public life are desperately unfunny.
Hear, hear. What word makes you laugh, Kevin?
Well, this is the word that makes me laugh is kerfuffle. It's used a lot in Little Britain. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what it means, except perhaps it means a bit of a fuss. But it's a hard word to say without thinking, well, that's a funny word. So kerfuffle.
Kerfuffle. It's a funny word. It's a funny word. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Well, I'd hoped that this question was non-binary, to coin a contemporary phrase, and that one is allowed to say they like to be both clever and funny. But I guess, sadly, I'd probably choose cleverer as a kind of as a way of living my life. But I would hate to think that that means I couldn't also claim occasionally to be funny.
And finally, Kevin, if you could only take one joke with you to a desert island, what would it be?
Well, it is. This puts me on the spot because I'm not a comedian. I'm about to try and tell a joke in public for the first time. But so here's the joke. There's a piece of string, and the piece of string goes into a pub and says to the landlord, "Could I have a pint of lager, please?" Lana says, "I'm really sorry, mate, but we don't serve string in here. So can you get out?" Piece of string's really upset, but likes this pub a lot, so he thinks he'll try it again. Goes into the pub the next week, says, "Can I have a pint of lager, please?" And he said, "I've told you, we don't serve string in here. Get out." Third time lucky, he hopes. The piece of string basically puts a loop around his middle, messes up the end of the string so it gets into lots of different fibres, goes into the pub. And the landlord says, "Aren't you that piece of string I've thrown out twice already?" And he said, "No, I'm afraid not."
Beautiful. And beautifully told for your first live telling of a joke on a show. Beautiful.
Thank you. Very generous of you.
Oh, no, it was wonderful. It's very generous of you to have taken the time with us and our kerfuffle here at the Humorology Podcast. Thank you so much for your comedy and your caring, Kevin.
Pleasure. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Humorology Podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.